Good evening, friends. This is Franz Weinschenk, your host on Valley Writers Read, delighted to introduce tonight's story, which deals with the very last part of the Civil War and takes place down in Texas. The author is certainly no stranger to our program. Her name is Bonnie Hearn Hill, and she entitles her story Part Light, Part Memory. Here she is, Bonnie Hearn Hill, reading Part Light, Part Memory.
Part Light, Part Memory, 1865, Galveston, Texas. They are not all good and not all evil, little Mary, and neither are we. My father told me that right before they hanged him. For looking at a white woman, they said. For looking, yes. For looking proud, for looking strong and fearless, even as his lifeless shadow sloped across the dusty ground and his silence shouted down the jeers of those who had come to watch. I'll kill her, I promised, my final glimpse of his body dangling from the noose. Then I turned away from the sight before it broke me. Alvis frowned me silent with a look that said they'd hang us too if I didn't hush. He found me later that day, crying in the barn, when I was supposed to be fetching water from Miss Bessie's bath. Usually the strength of him beside me could help me bear any misery, but not then. "Don't, little Mary," he said. "Don't let them see, especially don't let Mister see you hurting." In the lingering light, his skin glowed like gold. "I can't help it," I whispered as tears choked my vision and blurred him up tall and strong as a man older than his years. "He was my father. It was evil what they did." "I know that," Alvis said, his eyes offering no hope. "But you're just a girl, barely 15. "A girl who knows the truth," I said. "John William never looked at that white woman. He loved Big Mary." "Don't start," he said. "It won't do no good." He never looked, not even after. I couldn't finish, but Alvis knew. "Big Mary be sold when?" he asked. "3 years now?" "My brother Henry, too. I remembered the day, the spot of sunlight beside the patch of purple ground cherry, where my mother had stood rooted as a tree, how they dragged her past that spot into darkness. I could still hear her screams, "My babies, please save my babies." "About that long," I said. "But I know that Miss Bessie got him killed. And one day, Alvis, I'll kill Miss Bessie, too." "Don't," he said. "You can't live for killing." I turned away from him and headed back to the house. "I can," I said. After that, I did live for killing, although I didn't talk to Alvis about it. He was my sweet man, but now there was no room for him in my heart. The hate kept growing, pushing at the soft side of me. It reminded me of Big Mary gone, of my brother Henry gone, of my father gone, his body still swinging in the shadows of my dreams. The Monday after the hanging, it stormed that angry, unnatural way it sometimes does in June in Texas. Sheet lightning cut the air, and Mister cursed about the cotton. I forced myself to lift the silver-handled brush and bring it through Miss Bessie's hair, down her long, milky neck, so smooth that it was all I could do just to keep from grabbing her by the throat and squeezing the life from her. She was the woman, they said, John William, my father, looked at, the reason he got hanged. Ms. Bessie, who had pretended to be kind to him in those days after Big Mary was taken. Ms. Bessie, half crazy herself after little Chuck, her boy, caught the yellow fever and died. Ms. Bessie, who got my father killed. As I brought the brush down through her hair, I promised myself that I would find a way to kill her, too. She watched my face in the mirror that day, with the look she got when she thought no one else was noticing. The strands in my dark fingers shone like coins in the sunlight. I wished the brush were a hatchet, an axe with a sharp silver edge. Oh, how I'd rip it through her long white neck. "Amazing grace," she said. I jerked at that, "Ma'am?" "It's a hymn. When I think I can't take any more, I sing it." What did she know about hymns and having to suffer? "Yes'm," I said, and began braiding those silky strands, hating her even more for the blue eyes that could look gentle when they wanted to, the voice that could sound soft and good if you didn't know about her. I'd have her hair braided and pinned soon. I'd help her put on the black riding hat with its billed crown and sheer golden drapes that would fly behind her as she rode. And what would I do next? Could I let her leave here for an afternoon of horseback riding with my father's murder crowding out my every thought? She caught my eyes in the mirror again. "You don't even have to sing it, little Mary. Sometimes you can just hum it." "Yes'm." She frowned as if to tell me I didn't have to use slave talk with her. "I'm so sorry about what happened to John Williams," she said. "He was a good man, and he loved your mother very much." In the mirror, I caught what looked like tears in her eyes. Then I saw myself, my eyes hard as a hangman's, my face dark as hate, black as the sky when it was ready to storm down. The clothes she'd given me hung like rags from my narrow shoulders. I looked like the scarecrow man Mister stuck up in the field to frighten the birds away. "Yes," I paused. "Yes'm," I said again. "It's going to be over very soon, you know." "What, ma'am? What's going to be over?" It was better to act as if I didn't know, as if I'd never seen a copy of the Galveston News. The South had recaptured us last year, but it wasn't any worse or any better than when the North claimed us 2 years before that. Now nothing that happened would free my father. Nothing but heaven would bring him back to me. "Everything," Miss Bessie said. And turning from the mirror, she let her eyes blaze through mine. Then she dropped her head. When she lifted it, her eyes were full of tears. "I lost my son," she said, "my baby. And I lost my father," I answered in the language she had given me, forgetting to talk like a slave. "And John William lost Big Mary," she said. The flow of her tears was steady now. "Loss isn't only a person," she said. "It's a connection. It joins people the way grief does." My grief went far too deep to connect me to her. I nodded just the same and said, "It does, ma'am." "We're just women," Miss Bessie said, "weak women. We can't change anything. But how do you think John William felt?" "He felt weak too, ma'am," I said. "And to myself, because of you." Again the need for revenge burned in my fingers and my brain. Just then Mister burst into the room. He had to be the biggest, blondest man in all of Texas. I wished I could duck out of there before he gave me that look that always made me feel used and dirty. His pants were hitched up above his thick waist, his pale hair slicked down hard around his skull. But what kept me watching, hoping I could find a way out of that room, was a smile on his face that was anything but joyful, the colorless, cruel eyes narrowing on me. "What's she doing here?" he asked Miss Bessie, looking me up and down in that way of his. When I glanced up from Miss Bessie's hair again, I knew he was staring at her now and not at me. I wouldn't have wanted that look. Miss Bessie didn't either. I could see that by the way she huddled inside her thin wrap. Then just as I settled my hands around her shoulders, protective-like, I reminded myself that this was the woman who caused my father to die. "She's always here at this time," Miss Bessie said. "You ain't given her another reading lesson," Mister asked, the smile twitching as if he had a tick. I felt my cheeks burn and saw a similar flush on Miss Bessie's cheeks, too. I just taught her enough to read the Bible. Before she could say anything else, he slapped her across the face. She screamed and crumbled to the floor. I jumped back, glaring at him, realizing that maybe I didn't have to kill this woman anyway. Maybe something else would happen, and I wouldn't have to do anything. "You want the same?" he asked, waving his fist at me. "No, sir." Huddled beside her dressing table, Miss Bessie gazed into my eyes as if saying yes, it was best to hide my true speech. If he knew she'd taught me to read, he'd kill me right here. He stepped around her and gave me that smile. "You slaves know everything," he said. "Sir?" "Don't pretend with me," he said. "You've heard what's happened. You know it's only a matter of time." I'd heard, yes, from Alvis that the war was ending, that even with President Lincoln dead, we might be free. But I didn't believe it. I tried to think of something to keep Mister from doing to me what he'd done to Miss Bessie. "I don't care about that," I said. "Well, I care." He stomped his big, muddy boot too close to me. "As long as I'm alive, my slaves will do as I say." "Charles," Miss Bessie said in a voice stronger than she looked, "leave her alone. She hasn't done anything." "But her daddy did," he said. "John William did." "He didn't," I said. I didn't care what happened to me. I couldn't let him speak against my father. "He looked at Bessie," Mister shouted. "He dared to look at my wife." "Charles, don't." Miss Bessie pulled herself to her feet. Her face was scarlet, her eyes full of fear. "Not in front of her." "Go on, then," he said to me, and I dashed out of the room before he could change his mind. Then, as quickly as I'd left, I stopped. Something stronger than fear pulled me back. He was going to hurt her, I knew, but what could I do to stop him? And if I could stop him, why would I want to? As I stood outside the room, I could hear Miss Bessie sobbing. "I taught him to read the Bible," she said. "That was all." "Don't lie to me," Mister said. "You're lucky I didn't tell them to hang you, too." "Would you have liked that, Charles?" Her voice went sharp, and I cringed. "One more death to make you feel alive?" "Don't you ever speak to me like that," he said. And when she cried out, I knew he'd hit her again. The sound brought tears to my eyes. "You're my wife," he said. "Understand? I don't want you reading to them. I don't want you touching them. Especially, I don't want you touching them." "As you wish." Her voice sounded weary with tears. "Before long, we'll have no slaves to argue about. It will all be over soon." "It already is," he said. My skin prickled. "That devil Lincoln, I'm glad he's dead." "What do you mean?" she asked. "How do you know?" "Messengers," he said, and the hard laugh that followed chilled my bones. "Lincoln tried to send one down here before he got shot. Now they're trying again." "What messengers, Charles?" she asked in a strangled voice. "Dead ones." "No. Lee may have surrendered, but we're fighting for what's ours," he said. "I have to go down to the harbor. A ship is on its way. We're going to make sure those devils never make it here." I couldn't understand what she was saying through her sobs, but then she cried out again, a sudden shriek of pain, and I realized that I had too. I took off running, not knowing where I was going, only that I needed to find someone, Alvis, to tell what I'd heard, to keep Mister from carrying out his plan. The rain had stopped, but the sky was heavy and black. A sheet of lightning hit it, but I didn't stop, dashing past the ground cherry, the barn. If I could make it to the cotton field, I'd have a chance. Something heavy pulled me from behind, and I fell, sprawling in the primroses, my face smashed into their strong, sugary scent, followed by the smell of mud. That's where I was, face down in mud, trying to find my feet. "Get up." Mister's boot stabbed my side. I screamed and scrambled up. "Now get in there," he said, pointing at the barn. To do so would end my life, I knew. I stepped back, ready to run again. Before I could, he reached out and grabbed my arm. "No," I said, "please." Tears ran down my face as he dragged me inside. My father hadn't begged. I couldn't beg either, no matter what. He let go and shoved me onto the dirt floor. "You know the real reason I had John William hanged?" he asked. "Tell me you know, little Mary." "No." I crouched in the dust he'd kicked around, staring up at him. In the barn light, his face was twisted and hungry. I forced myself to slow my speech. "I don't know nothing, sir." I caught them together, he said, his voice sing-song. I had to protect my reputation and hers. Couldn't let anyone know. He hooked his thumbs into the waist of his pants and looked at me like a little boy getting ready to torture a bug. I think I owe him one, don't you? John William and Miss Bessie? I thought of what she had said about loss, about how it connected people. Nothing my father did could have been bad. I fought to keep the fear from my voice. What do you mean you owe him one? I asked. Get up and I'll show you. No, I said. He was going to kill me anyway. I wouldn't allow him any other pleasure. Your black devil of a father took something from me, he said. I hope he's watching from hell right now. No, I repeated. I couldn't stop myself. Did you say no? The boot again. A rush of pain choked out a moan from me. I rolled to my side, cutting my face on something sharp, a rusted tool. You get up right now, little Mary, he said, or I'll fix you so you can't. Through my tears, I focused on the discarded tools I rolled onto. Shovel, hoe, pitchfork. I would not beg, I would fight. And if he killed me, as he surely would, I could face my father with pride. I got on my knees as if I was praying. Yes, sir, I said. Good, you're as smart as you are pretty. His hands moved to the front of his pants. Don't look so scared. You might like it. I pulled myself up, slowly, leaning on the pitchfork, forcing the fear out of my head. His pants loosened and fell. I gripped the handle as if for support, learning the feel of it with my fingers. He smiled and said, "What's the matter, little Mary? You never seen a real man before?" In that one movement, I swung the pitchfork, drove it into that part of him he'd revealed to me. Mister let out a scream that will follow me to the grave. Right then, though, lost to rage, I pulled the pitchfork from his jerking body, and when he toppled to the ground, I drove it into him again and again. Then I looked down at what I'd done, and tears burned on my frozen cheeks. I, who had talked of killing to Alvis as if I knew it well, hadn't begun to understand how it felt to take the life from another person, even in order to save my own. Mister and others like him would not have been able to stop the messengers who sailed into Galveston that day. Men in blue uniforms filled the streets, they say, and soon they marched down every road under the leaden sky. Miss Bessie met the soldiers at the gate and brought the news inside the house to me, her face as pale as flour. "You're free, little Mary," she said. "Free?" The sound of cheering came from outside. I began to tremble. "Free." She took off the black hat from her dressing table and handed it to me. I stumbled out my thanks, unable to complete a simple sentence. Miss Bessie looked at my helpless hands and said, "Sit down." And there I was in front of her mirror. She reached for her hairbrush and, lifting the silver handle, swept up my hair, smoothing it up to my crown, not speaking, only humming softly, "Amazing Grace." Then, when the hat was secure and I'd gotten up, she sat down at the dressing table and put her head in her hands. I looked in wonder at myself, my black, free self, and then I ran down the stairs to where Alvis waited. Him shouted like thunder, like a storm of joy. Together we rushed out to join the dance. Jubilee, the other slaves called it that night of our celebration, and later Juneteenth. Although we didn't know it then, we'd been free for more than 2 years. My father had been free and hadn't even known it. Some slaves left that night. The ones with kinder masters dressed up in their clothes, wearing their joy and disbelief in those ridiculous garments, as I wore Miss Bessie's hat. Later we told our children about it, about the way we laughed and sang and cried. One day they will tell their children so that the future can remember. Mister ran off, they said, when he heard the news was coming. Said he couldn't bear to stay to witness what he knew would happen. The ending, the beginning. Some even thought he might have taken his own life. The poor missus, they said. Poor Miss Bessie. We've stayed with her, Alvis and me, our three sons and one daughter, all of these years, in our own house right beside hers. She's an old lady now, her eyes a calm blue most of the time, the ghost gone. Now and again she still hums that hymn. Now and again I hum it too. The primrose still blooms every spring, filling the air with the smell of grape. The purple ground cherry has spread like a potato vine. Same plants, different flowers. Sometimes when the sun slants against the side of the barn at dusk, the way it's doing right now, and the tangled shadow of the silver maple tree stands there looking back at me, I think about my father. They are not all good and not all evil, little Mary, and neither are we. Alvis comes out and stands beside me. His big hand warms my arm like the sun. What are you looking at? He asks. Nothing much, I say. I'll go back inside then. You can stay. In the faint light our eyes meet, and I know that he knows I'm carrying a secret, and that it's not one he can ever help me bear. I'll go on in. Have you tended to Miss Bessie yet? I will. In the moment he takes his hand away, I feel cold. You've got that look again, he says, not moving from my side. I can always tell when you're thinking about those times. Sometimes I can't help but think about them, I tell him, but mostly I don't. You know that. Nobody can change what happened, he says, and in his voice I can tell that he wants this talk of ours to be over. We're free now. We can't look back. Free. I wouldn't go back for anything, I tell him, and realize how much I mean it. It's good how it worked out, he says. Good you didn't do what you was thinking after they hanged your daddy. I wouldn't have wanted my woman to do something like that. No, I say, I wouldn't have wanted to. And it wasn't Miss Bessie's fault. It was that evil man of hers. Yes, I say, it's good how it worked out. He narrows his eyes as if trying to make out the shape of another person standing here with us, and I can almost guess what he's thinking. Mister, he says, shaking his head. I wonder what happened to Mister. No telling. I look down at my hands and see that they are steady. A lot of them just ran off. Guess we'll never know. And that's good, too. He touches me briefly again and gives me a smile that's as much sadness as anything else. Don't be thinking back on those times, little Mary, he says. Ain't nothing there but sorrow. You're right, I say. I won't. And now I'd better go tend to Miss Bessie. I've never told Alvis about those hours before the messenger, when Miss Bessie stepped inside the dim light of the barn, and seeing what I'd done said, "Come now, we must hurry." I watch him walk back inside, this large, honest man who thinks he protects me, this man who was afraid I'd kill the woman who may have been the only person who could share my father's pain. I see his shoulders relax as if someone has lifted a weight from them. And I see something else right then, a reflection from the barn, part light, part memory. Two women, neither one of us very large, but that day with the shovel, the pitchfork, in the mixed scent of hay and blood, we were strong.
Sometimes I feel
That
That was Bonnie Herne Hill reading Part Light, Part Memory. As we heard, the story was about the very last months of the Civil War when, even after Lee's surrender and even after the assassination of President Lincoln, parts of the South still did not want to acknowledge the fact that slavery was over. In the story we just heard, we witnessed the ruthlessness, cruelty, and maltreatment of black people by their former owners, who, even though the North had clearly won the war, still refused to admit that they had been defeated and would not relinquish their hold on their former slaves. And, as our story tonight showed, they considered it a major crime for a white person to teach black people to read and write, even resorted to lynchings and raping their victims. Friends, Bonnie Herne Hill was among the very first six authors to read for us on this program. She's a very well-published author, used to be an editor for the Fresno Bee, and often teaches writing classes to up-and-coming authors. Over all these many years, we really appreciate her support and her many fine contributions to our show. Along with her husband, Larry, who's also a fine writer, we hope to feature more of her outstanding fiction in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read programs again, just go on the web at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our writer reader will be Howard Hendricks. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.